This is Renegade Broadcasting.
Coming. Our storm. And when it arrives, it will shake the universe.
Welcome to the Solar Storm. This is your host, Kyle Hunt, coming to you June 12th, 2016. Thank you so much for joining me here on RenegadeBroadcasting.com. I want to encourage you to please check out all of the great shows here on the network. I hosted the roundtable last night, so please check that out as we had a lot of great callers. Also, go over to RenegadeTribune.com. We have a lot of great authors and great content in general over there. Tonight, I have the founder of the Sunwheel Society, or one of the founders, Mr. Arthur Bliss, and he was instrumental in the making of an adaptation of Rosenberg's very famous The Myth of the 20th Century. And some of you have seen this this film adaptation recently, as I have featured it on the Tribune, and I posted it in the chat, and it is titled The Myth. It's about 4 hours long. It's an audiobook, essentially, along with some very compelling images that slowly transition throughout the video. It is separated into three different parts, so you can consume it in chunks. I really recommend that you do. What you will find is that Alfred Rosenberg had some very, very deep insights into the nature of our struggle and how far back it goes. We'll be learning much more about that tonight. And hopefully, with this knowledge, we'll be able to better direct ourselves towards the kind of future that we want to see for our people. With that being said, welcome to the show, Arthur. Thank you very much for being here.
Thank you, Kyle.
What can you tell us about yourself and the Sunwheel Society?
Well, not a whole lot. We're kind of quiet about who we are individually. But I will say we're a small group. And our goal essentially is what you just described, trying to figure out and encourage a better future society. A lot of people have realized that things are kind of messed up in the current world. And there are a lot of views on why that is. Of course, a lot of evidence about specific instances of problems in our culture. But we want to kind of go beyond that. And part of that is not just going back, not just being, say, conservative or traditional, to kind of restore things 100 years ago, but to try to find out the fundamental truth that moves forward in time with our people, and then see how that can play out in a future society that's appropriate for that time, but also appropriate for our people. And that's also what the myth's about.
Before we get to the myth, let us deal with the man. What can you tell us about Mr. Rosenberg?
Well, he was a nice guy. I mean, he wasn't a soldier. He had a great respect for the military aspect of Germanic culture. But he was a philosopher, a historian. He actually had been trained as an architect. He was originally from Estonia, but he was a Baltic German. And he was one of the first members of the NSDAP. When Hitler was imprisoned, Hitler transferred the authority of the party to Rosenberg for that entire time. He trusted him a great deal. He had written a number of things, and he was really instrumental to the inner sense of duty and vision for the National Socialists. You know, he wrote the party program, but he wasn't a military strategist. He was a philosopher fundamentally.
The Myth of the 20th Century came out in 1930, correct?
Yes, and then there were three revisions after that. Yeah.
Is the publication of this book and the controversy that it caused one of the reasons that Rosenberg did not play such a leading role later on in the party, and why we may have not heard so much about him or seen much about him in a lot of the movies that have been made?
Well, that's a really good question. You know, a lot of the interest in, you know, the Third Reich is focused on their military. There's a persistent military-based admiration for what they accomplished among Americans, among Brits, among people throughout the world. I mean, they had an excellent military, and many of the things that they did modernized a lot of the military thinking that we still apply today. Economically, you know, social programs, all these things also are specific expressions of that government. And those are easily relatable to, you know, to now. And so we have things like interstates, for example. We're aware about, you know, not smoking, a lot of the kind of biodynamic or organic farming stuff. All, you know, nature conservation was already going on, but a lot of this stuff we can trace to, at least sympathetically, to the things that they did. But behind that were the ideas. There's a book by Gustave Le Bon called The Crowd. It's a very short book, and it was written towards the end of the 19th century. And one of the ideas, it's an excellent book, and it talks about essentially how people decide things in a crowd and why it is so problematic, although it can be capable of doing great things. But one of the things that it really, really puts forward some strong arguments on is the way that when a culture reaches the point of actually electing people or following a leader into some kind of new era, that's not something that just happened that week. It's not even something that happened that generation. It's something that kind of built up first among some more intellectual types or some artists or whatnot, and then spread into kind of different circles until it was part of the marrow of the people. And then it got expressed. And this can be something good or something bad. I mean, you can look at the 20th century and what's happened in the academic world and how academics had a lot of ideas. I'm talking about left-wing academics that are now accepted as commonplace. But in 1920 or 1950, you know, that's a radical left-wing idea. Well, now it's just mainstream. Everybody knows that. Maybe that was all deliberate, but it definitely operates as a function of this emanation. But people don't know about a lot of those left-wing philosophers. And just in the same way, a lot of people don't know about Rosenberg and, in fact, the people who were before him.
Right. People see the forest now, but they don't think about who was planting the seeds perhaps 100 years ago. So Rosenberg did cause quite a deal of controversy with this because it was very critical of Christianity. And a lot of the moves that were made by the Reich were to align with the Christian church and in particular with the Vatican. And from what I've researched, it seems that Rosenberg was denied some position simply because it would cause too much conflict within the party and with relations with people like the Vatican if he was to be seen as having a real powerful position. Have you looked into this at all?
Mm-hmm. A lot of the introduction to the third edition, which we didn't include, deals with this, not specifically kind of the political maneuver, but essentially the huge reaction from the Christian churches, especially the Catholic Church. I mean, this was somebody who was one of those few individuals, you know, perhaps like yourself, that is willing to just say genuinely what they think, regardless of what most people are going to believe about it. I mean, they're not just trying to, you know, create chaos. This is really what they believe. he had a real integrity. But that doesn't, you know, make a very good politician. It doesn't even necessarily make a very good leader. Sometimes, you know, people need to be diplomatic. You think of like Bismarck, who Rosenberg admired. I mean, Bismarck's famous for being very shrewd in how he dealt with different folks and very successful through those shrewd dealings. But that also meant he was not as forthright. And Rosenberg was a much more forthright kind of person.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that is certainly the case. Taking a look at his work, he was not pulling any punches here. Are you aware of Hitler's views on Rosenberg's work and their relationship with each other?
Well, so they're complicated because a lot of it comes from things like Bormann's Hitler's table talk, or you have, you know, later hearsay from, you know, his bodyguard or whatnot. There was a real interest, in suppressing Rosenberg's work and telling everyone that it was way too boring to read. It had no influence on anything. It was unimportant. He was some windbag that just, chattered on about things nobody really cared about. Maybe they paid it lip service, but, you know, it was a joke to them. And that just isn't the case. We know that Rosenberg and Hitler were very close. We know that Hitler trusted Rosenberg a great deal. And you can see in Hitler's writings, in Hitler's speeches, the character that Rosenberg is describing when he's seeing a vision for the German people. And Hitler is a very interesting personality in his own right, obviously. But I don't think that they were ever opposed to each other. My understanding is that Goebbels and Rosenberg, you know, may have had some different things. I mean, essentially because, like I said, Rosenberg was kind of the quintessential, plain speaker. So, but even that, you know, seems to be exaggerated and along these lines of wanting people to think that nobody read it, it was not interesting, and whatever you do, don't read it.
It would seem like Himmler might have been particularly interested in Rosenberg's work. Is there any information in that regard?
I don't know of anything specifically, although I do know that, you know, Rosenberg was both open to kind of a renewal of kind of like mystical ways, but you know, anything that kind of starts going into the occult, where it's kind of magical thinking, Rosenberg clearly had a dim view of, you know. So he may have, as far as I know, he may have been just as offended as the Christians. I just don't know.
Okay. What about these claims made up until today that Rosenberg was a Jew because he came from parents who were in the merchant class of Eastern Europe, and also because of his last name? Now, just to put this out there, a lot of the people that say he was a Jew do so because they are very offended about his views on Christianity. So they're saying he must be a Jew because look at the name, and also look how he attacks Christianity. That's a Jewish thing to do. That's the way that they are thinking. Do you have any information regarding his lineage?
Well, I mean, you have to recall that all of the German sounding Jewish last names were not original Jewish names. They were purchased. They were acquired names. And this includes names like Rosenberg. We hear a lot of Berg. Berg means mountain. So, you know, Goldberg is Gold Mountain. You know, I mean, so it's Rosenberg is a mountain of roses, or a rose mountain. I mean, it's a nice sounding name. And if I was Jewish, I might want to buy that name. But, you know, it doesn't reflect on all people with the name Rosenberg. And it's unfortunate that there's this conflation. That said, the specific accusations, seem clearly like saying that Hitler had Jewish ancestry. It's essentially to do two things. One is to, to make the person seem hypocritical and ridiculous in their own self, but it's also to fit them into this archetype of the self-hating Jew, which is a specific part of Jewish culture. And, you know, so once you do that, then you can kind of, you can process this in some way, that maybe it just doesn't make sense otherwise. But if you want to know for yourself, I mean, besides the fact that, you can trace Rosenberg's lineage and you can see he's definitely not Jewish. You just have to read his book, The Track of the Jew Through the Ages, which is much easier than The Myth of the 20th Century. And you can, it's an earlier book, and you can really see he lays out again and again how throughout history, the Jewish people have kind of expressed this type of nature, and what it is and so forth. Whereas the other people in particular, through numerous examples, the Germanic peoples of different countries have a different kind of nature. And the way that relationship takes place is often one of exploitation. But, I mean, he makes a point of noting that it's often because European folk may want to kind of have a shortcut, maybe a loan, or a king wants to stay in power or something, so we aren't blameless as a people, but that also tells us how we can perhaps become more immune to it. And I think you mentioned it at the beginning about materialism.
Yes. Actually, I think I mentioned that before we started recording, but maybe we can get into that in just a little bit. Let's now move over to the book itself. As I said, published in 1930, and he released later revisions as well. What can you tell us about this text, the circulation it had, and just what is contained within it, and how you went about trimming it down to a quarter of its size?
Well, it's a million. It was printed about a million times. It had pretty wide readership, especially, of course, within the leadership, and not just the top leadership. It really was a very influential book. Unlike Mein Kampf, which was very widely distributed, this was something that there was actually a demand for, and I think the demand was stimulated, in fact, by the negative reaction with the first printing. It doesn't strike me, however, as a book that was ever written, for everyone. This is a book that's speaking to someone that is already kind of, ready for it in a certain way. It is a large book, not, Schopenhauer, huge, but it is a pretty large book. The English version being, say over 400 pages or so. The translation that I use, by Dr. Whisker, is a very literal translation. And when I went to the German, you could really see this, and in some cases had to retranslate things because it was just too literal to get the point across. So you have to take into account that you're talking about a book written, in really still kind of the late 19th century German style of philosophy. So long sentences, very beautiful in its own way. But definitely not Latin style, very Germanic style. So heavy, dense. It's like Kant or even Aristotle, even though that's, a little different. But it's just that kind of density. And so it's some effort to work through it. To abridge it, I essentially did two passes. One was a pretty heavy cut, and then going through a little more finely. There were a lot of good things left out. Probably the largest section was the aesthetics, which are very important. But he has a lot to say about art, and it's very important stuff. But it does not apply as much to everyone that is kind of interested in these things. But it is definitely worth reading in the original. He also talks about a lot about German mysticism it's almost a counterbalance for the criticism he talks about Christianity. He describes these forms of Christianity that, or if they could even be called Christianity, where it's this Germanic search for the spiritual truth, and several other things. So essentially, and I included some of the historical digressions, especially about the peoples that were most familiar with, the Greeks and the Romans in particular. But there are a lot. I mean, he's a historian as well as a philosopher. So if that's your thing, you should definitely read the original.
I know you've probably given a roundabout answer to this already, but out of all of the books that could be chosen to make into an audiobook and into a film, even just within the Third Reich time period, there are so many. It's overwhelming. Why was this the one that you thought needed to be made more palatable, more accessible for our audience?
Well, that's a very good question. So two reasons. One is because I genuinely believe it's the most important work to come out of the Third Reich. And when I say important, I don't mean necessarily important to understanding that period of time. There are definitely other texts that are more important, Mein Kampf, for example. But to really understand what is true, and a lot of kind of what we're all kind of struggling with, what we're all trying to find about who are we? What are we supposed to do? What is the meaning of all this? What are we, where are we headed? And he's not saying it in a kind of a, you know, I went up on the mountain, I have all the answers kind of way, but it's like, hey, you already know, you know, it's, you can find all the truth that you need really in understanding like a family. The other reason is because it is, it may not be the most suppressed book, but it is definitely up there. You know, no one seems to even have heard of it. Very few people, you know, have genuinely read it. I think, most of the people who read it are reading it to write nasty things about it. So
you start off in the video with scrolling text to kind of set the stage. And it's very interesting how Alfred Rosenberg met his end. He was charged and hung for war crimes, yet he did not serve in the German army. Nothing in terms of the Holocaust was ever even remotely pinned on him. Do you think that his work was just that powerful, that his brain, his understanding was just too dangerous, that is why they had to eliminate him?
Well, why did they kill any of them? You know, I mean, they could have just locked them in prison, you know, cut off their tongues, you know. I mean, they set out to destroy these sentiments and to frighten everyone from having them, either frighten them from the danger of being as horrible as the Nazis, or frighten them from, you know, owning any kind of sympathy to this, because they, you know, would suffer under denazification, you know, and people died for that. Not a whole lot of people died, but a lot of people were blacklisted for it. It was a really, really oppressive period of German history. So, you know, the way a lot of this works, unless you have, we have this Western culture that really is a beautiful thing, even in its, you know, kind of decomposing state right now. Hopefully it renews itself, but, you know, it won't tolerate people just being rounded up and shot on the streets. It won't tolerate that. So in order to suppress our people, it's necessary to operate in a more subtle way. And one of the ways of doing this is to assume the mantle of justice. So you must claim that the person that you're suppressing is absolutely the devil, is the worst person ever. And that justifies, you know, not really so much executing them, which is not that big of a deal in itself. It's the execution of the idea. And then, you know, in addition, that demonization makes it so that because we don't want to be bad people, we will not, as good people, all of us wanting to be good people, I mean, except the most criminal among us, want to associate ourselves with things that have the names racism or anti-Semitism or all these horrible things.
Nazis,
exactly. It's effective, but it wouldn't be effective in most cultures. In most cultures, the most effective thing to do would be just kill everyone who disagrees with you, you know, and then they'd just be scared. But in our culture, an honor-bound culture, you actually have to convince people, whether they're voting for Bernie or Trump or whatever, that they're doing the right thing, because that's what we respond to as people.
Mm-hmm. I think it is very important that we ensure that the zeitgeist of our ages is one that is in tune with our spirit, that is good for our folk, and one that is not imposed externally upon us. And I think that your film here is an essential component to ensuring that at least the people who see this, who I would consider our elite, are on the right track. And hopefully this will radiate out at least the ideas contained within it, even if people don't see it firsthand themselves. I hope they do. But hopefully this will help to shape our zeitgeist, because right now, I really do think we are in the eye of the storm. Let's get into the content of the book itself, and then, of course, the film. Where does it all start? It goes back thousands of years. Rosenberg tracks it back to Rome and to Greece and to the past glory. What are some of the lessons we can learn, and where does this all start?
Mm-hmm. Well, honestly, it starts with nature. You know, it is truly timeless, and it's the mystery. It's the thing that we all seem to have forgotten, that you know, that you as a person, as an individual, have a certain soul to you that would be you, whether you live now or in the Roman times or in a time 2,000 years from now. It is who you are. And yes, it interacts with the environment and the culture and the experiences that are available to you. But there is something innate within you, something that is natural to you. And you know, Rosenberg terms this the myth, and it would be the myth of you. And if you understand, you know, essentially that you is kind of has to be who you are. It just must. And the more you repress who you are, the less happy and healthy and natural of a person you'll be. But you have to be you. That's kind of the first beginning. It's understanding the self, and then realizing that, you know, the people that you are of a stronger blood relationship with are going to be more like you, just like your family, even if their, you know, their political notions or whatever are opposite yours in certain ways. I mean, the reality is that something fundamentally underneath that, before it was, you know, headed down one road or another, is really like you. And that is the basis for kinship, you know, but it's the myth of the people then, not just the person. So we see this throughout history, and the lesson is a lot like, when he talks about history, it's similar. You see a very common kind of story that was, really clear, to historians in the past, and it essentially is that you have a group that establishes something, and they're successful, and then as a different people come into it, perhaps as slaves or as immigrants or as a kind of tolerant society, we let them in, or we're trading with them, or we need them for some reason, or maybe we even do battle with them, and you know, somehow there's some kind of cross-pollination. The more we lose, or that society loses its identity, the more it, it deteriorates. Its strength as a people lessens, because it is diffuse, and it doesn't become the other people. It doesn't become the aliens to it. It becomes something else, something weak, something that is incomplete in its soul, and so it dies as a social organism. It dies because it cannot be, you know, all things at once. It cannot be two complete beings at the same time. And the only chance of that is where you have people that are already so similar that they really can blend and make something new, the way that a man and a woman can blend and make a child. And that the success they'll have at that is related to how much they are within, you know, some kin group. Because, you know, the more distant they are from each other, the more genetically the child is unlike either of them and doesn't really represent a complete person.
It really does seem that when there is some kind of foreign injection into an ethnic group from another ethnic group that's close to them, it is not nearly as disastrous, like the Irish with the Norse injection that they had. In some ways, it could even strengthen these people. But what we have with alien culture is much different. Folks, this is our first break. We'll be back with much, much more. Stay tuned.
Judge the intention. Alex Jones here. I have hacked into the Renegade Matrix to bring you this message. The Nazis on this network have been lying to you. It's not the Jews in charge of the NWO. They're not committing white genocide. The real enemy is the Germanic death cult setting up their Fourth Reich. And Renegade Broadcasting is the new Aryan Axis. I think the Gestapo are coming to silence me. And if you're hearing this, you are the Resistance.
Welcome back to the Solar Storm. My guest tonight is the man behind the myth out here, Mr. Arthur Bliss. And before the break, we were talking about Rosenberg's views of antiquity. And what I was able to gather is that you had the Aryan nobility that was very much a driving force behind these amazing civilizations that arose. And then, of course, the multiculturalism sets in. Basically, the steel becomes impure and therefore fragile and brittle and breaks apart. And that is what race mixing causes. And so there are many reasons for a civilization's downfall, but one of the main ones seems to definitely be multiculturalism and race mixing, and this is one of the main points that's made in March of the Titans as well, reviewing the history of the white race. I wanted to go and discuss the Etruscans, because Rosenberg spends some decent amount of time dealing with the Etruscans. What can you tell us about these people, and why, what were their ways, their myths, or their myth? Why was it just so much different than that of the more upward people of Greek and Roman glory? And of course, this did change over time, but it seems like there's this constant struggle between those who want to strive upward higher and higher and those who want to drag everybody down to the most base level. And Rosenberg seems to equate the Etruscans very much with this this kind of force that was dragging people down into dark kinds of mysticism and depravity.
Well, it's a good question. And, you know, one of the difficulties is that there's a certain modern scholarship on the Etruscans, and then there's a more historical scholarship on the Etruscans. And until, you know, the mid-19th century or so, it was pretty widely believed that the Etruscans were a Semitic people. There's still very good evidence for that. You'll hear different things, and I can't say with any certainty whether Rosenberg's notion that the Etruscans were Semitic is correct. What we do know is that they were different from the Romans, that they battled with the Romans, and that they were there already when the Roman families, the Gentiles, came over the mountains. And, you know, and that this conflict kind of lived on in some ways. And as the Roman Empire fell, the beliefs of the Etruscans, but also the beliefs of a lot of the different peoples in that area, you know, were absorbed into the Roman Empire, but probably more important, they were absorbed into what became, or what is still, the living entity that once was the Roman Empire, which is the Roman Catholic Church. You know, And so that's a lot of what he is talking about. There was, and part of the distinguishing characteristic of what he considers a Semitic Etruscan group, as well as the Syrian Jewish kind of thing, is this magical thinking, the superstition, this occult kind of belief, which, you know, everyone feels sometimes, because we want there to be not just explanations, but we want to have recourse to things that are frustrating or unfair and so forth. But some of, you know, for some peoples, this becomes a whole system of occult belief. And what's interesting to me is that for all of the focus on the supernatural in these kind of magical thinkings, a lot of it really revolves around essentially a materialistic reality, you know, a love potion to gain love, or a curse to curse somebody materially. And so they're essentially supernatural solutions to material problems. That's a different worldview of the spiritual than what the people coming from the north, you know, and who knows exactly where they came from originally. Certainly, like you said, the Irish and the Norse were not all that different, even though the Irish were there for a long time as Celts. Their belief was that there was essentially a nature that was fundamental, that we were all built upon this, that we were extensions of this, and that God or gods or anything that was, you know, kind of given that type of beyond just the immediate material, term, they were reflective of some kind of essential energy or aspect of nature. So they weren't magical, but they weren't chaos either. They weren't just atoms floating around in space without any order, without any law. They were rather the natural laws themselves. And this concept is actually very related to the concept of the myth.
Fascinating. Now, what can you tell us about some of the superstitious practices, or what it resulted in? Because some of what we see taking place within the Catholic Church, which you said basically took over from the Etruscans, is the elevation of ugliness in many regards. You look at their artwork and what they make their monks look like, and just the way that their heroes are depicted, it's very grotesque in many regards. They hate the beautiful. Even though at certain points the Catholic Church definitely employed fantastic artists to make their presence magnificent, you see that there is this elevation of the inferior and the suppression of the superior. What is this really all about, do you think?
Well, so a lot of it has to do with the denial of the material condition in favor of some future better material condition. And so, you know, the mortification of the flesh, you know, this idea that life is supposed to be suffering, you know, and the really strong association of piety with the crucifixion and the suffering, the martyrdom, that the whole message of Christ is within that. The suffering, the sacrifice, you had this all-powerful God who died and it was your fault. You know, these are heavy duty, heavy, heavy, heavy concepts to lay on some 5-year-old who's learning about, you know, what the world is. But that's what happens.
And they're indoctrinated with this concept of original sin. This is something that was completely alien to the European people, correct?
Well, yeah, and that's certainly Rosenberg's view. He says as much and gives a number of examples, you know, that it, and he associates it partly with, race mixing, that when a person isn't complete, when they don't have that sense of unity of who they are, that they belong in this world, that they are a wolf or they are a horse or they are their own human being, then there's this sense that something's wrong. Something's not right, and you want to fix it. You want to make it, you want to become whole. And so there's this need for this kind of, you know, transformation into a perfect future material world. And all suffering is kind of the wages of sin. It's all because we must be so sinful, rather than seeing suffering as, you know, kind of, as just part of life. It's not sinful in itself. It's not because we are evil. You know, you can understand it from a number of different perspectives, but it is most certainly not because we are just evil. So therefore we're here to be punished. You know, I mean, it's a really kind of masochistic concept. It's sick, honestly. And, what's odd about it is, you know, this is something that is also very prominent in Jewish culture and also in Muslim culture, and it's a Semitic belief. The original sin derives from, of course, the Genesis book, but it goes back further to the Canaanites, you know, and the religions that were in that area. And if we do see the Etruscans, regardless of whether they spoke a Semitic language or not, as being one of these original people, then you're talking about some people that apparently, you know, did have this infusion of some of the blood from North Africa and some of the blood from the Caucasus, and, you know, and they were the Caucasus Mountains, and they, you know, they were kind of these mixed people. They were part of these foundings. Some of the works of a little known historian named Lawrence Waddell or Waddell, you know, really talks about, he's a very interesting guy, but he points out that there are a lot of signs that even those, what we think of as like ancient civilizations, the Sumerians, for example, really actually were some of these original people that also then went up north, and they went to India, and they went to Persia, they went to Greece, they went to Egypt. And so what we see now in those areas, what we associate with those areas, were a different people that kind of overwhelmed those folks over time. So, and those people, all these people, the Jewish folks and so forth, they believe that the suffering that we endure is like, it's the Jewish, you know, it's the weight of being the chosen. It's, you know, they're supposed to have this because X, Y, Z, because they, you know, they failed God and they need to redeem themselves. But the redemption is a material paradise. Why? Because they are not content with nature, with reality.
Yes. That's very interesting. And you mentioned the original sin being actually race mixing. And the Abrahamic religions either are all for race mixing or are mainly comprised of race mixed people. The Jews are one good example of this, but also the Muslims, as is very apparent with all of these, as you mentioned, with all of the Aryan invasions that took place all across Asia and the Middle East, and what we see now. At once it was a civilization that was created by and for the Aryan elite, and now it's completely race mixed. And it is very interesting how you have the Pope now just endorsing the mass flooding of Europe, kissing the feet of the black invaders, and the church pretty much, at least, even though the doctrines have always kind of been there, you know, there is no Jew, there is no Greek, no Gentile, they've really ramped up the idea that to be holy, you have to basically race mix, because the original sin now has become not race mixing, but now being born white. Isn't that interesting?
Yeah, I mean, and you know, obviously there's some the you know, Catholic Church is in cahoots, you know, at least since Vatican II.
Rosenberg would think probably back all the way to its inception, right? It seems to be that would be his argument, though I'm sure throughout the centuries there have been a few different people that have somehow been able to gain the reins of the Vatican and at least perhaps do something for the betterment of the folk. I'm not sure. I'd have to look into that a little bit more.
You know, it's really interesting to think about, because, you know, when you look at it from the result, it is easy to see a conspiracy in it, because it is such an encompassing change. And we know that some folks deliberately conspire to achieve these things. But part of the problem, part of why it will not work to just go back to how things were even 200 years ago, is because there are fundamental issues with the ideology of Catholicism, but also of Christianity, that unless they are resolved, unless they are changed, they will lead this way again. There's a whole slew of conservative books that you know, say that what we have in our free Western society, you know, what Rosenberg deems humanism or humanitarianism is the product of the Christian church, because the Christian church values the equality of the soul, and it, you know, it essentially honors, you know, freedom, the liberty to choose God or to not choose God. And it doesn't matter whether a person's a sinner or a slave or a ruler or whatever, they're all kind of equal under God, and there's really no nation and all this stuff. And the crazy thing is, you know, they're right. They're right. All of this, you know, the liberal humanists who are atheists and would never consider themselves Christians. The reality is that they stem from, you know, a lot of the Christian philosophy. And the thing that they have in common is that they are in denial of simple natural truths, like you are who you are.
Well, Catholic means universalistic. Mm-hmm. So it's very much been a religion that has gone out with its missionaries and taken over the whole non-white world. And now what you have is majority of Christians on the planet are not even white. Mm-hmm. It's not a racial religion. It's not a European religion. It has always been a Semitic religion that simply conquered, perhaps as something of a mind virus, the European people and used us as a host to transmit it all around the world with our advanced technology, with our great ships, with our commerce, and most recently with the planes and the cars and the trains.
Mm-hmm. That's absolutely right. And it continues to do so, of course, as it does no longer need us as much. Now it kind of throws us in the trash, right?
And all that technology is used to bring the third world back to Europe and all white countries.
Hey, as long as they're Christians, what does it matter, right?
Right.
You know, it's you know, it's true. We can say, well, okay, well, there are multiple strains of Christianity and stuff. And, you know, the Catholic Church had to make some corrections, like it doesn't sell indulgences and stuff. But what we have to remember is that all came at the cost of blood. You know, one of the more interesting parts of the book that is not included is about the 30-year war. And, you know, that war killed millions and millions of Europeans. I can't remember exactly whether it was a third or a half of the Europeans in Europe, but they died in this war that the Catholic Church, you know, promulgated against, you know, non-believers in their authority. One of the first crusades was against the Cathars, you know, who dared to say that the original, you know, Jehovah was actually kind of like Satan and wasn't the God of Christ, you know, dared to defy the authority of the Pope. And, some were willing to just be martyred for that, but some were willing to fight for that. And, you know, they lost in some sense. Some areas were under Catholic control, but they also won because of this, you have the countries that have kind of the most, you know, element there that is most pure. The Scandinavian countries are a particular example of this, but I really mean the Nordic countries, so England as well, and Northern Germany, where Protestantism, you know, could not be kicked out. It had to be, because they just could not accept the rule of Rome. And because of that, Rome eventually bent. And I'm sure you saw there's a very interesting part where Rosenberg talks about how a lot of the most, you know, honorable saints, you know, of the tradition and, of Catholicism came directly from, you know, Germanic and Norse myth. You know, they just stole them essentially, like Martin, Saint Martin from Odin. And they took their things, and this worked. And there was a particular Pope, I can't remember his name, but when he was, you know, preaching, he said, okay, take their traditions, take the Christmas tree, take the Easter bunny, you know, whatever, and incorporate them, because, you know, partly because it was the only way. You couldn't kill these people.
And the Europeans took this Semitic religion and seemed to perhaps even alchemically make something decent out of it, at least for themselves. It became European in a certain sense. And they're basically, despite the mind programming that was laid over top of them, they retained a lot of their character and their values over the centuries.
Exactly. And that's what's so difficult about it, because you absolutely can find great examples of Christians or even the Catholic Church formally, you know, fighting against communism, fighting against the French Revolution, you know. And so you go, what the hell? You know, are they not on the right side? And sure they are, but things are not just, you know, dichotomous. There is another truth that is informing things. So things don't have to be more like Tom or more like Bob. They can be more like you. And that's, you know, what we have to discover as a people. And when we're ready to do that, you know, we won't need the whole of Christianity. We probably won't even need that much of Christianity. What we will retain will be the things that are truly vital to us. And maybe they're just traditions. Maybe we still do Christmas, you know, but in the end, what's really changed is what matters.
There was a Celtic god, Isis, who actually shared a lot of similarities with the later Jesus. And of course, there's Horus, and people have compared Balder to Jesus. But also, you have Osiris being another Jesus character as well. Horus and Osiris both. And even Odin himself, in some ways, hanging from the tree, mm-hmm. could be seen as a Jesus figure. Now, it seems that Alfred Rosenberg thought that Jesus himself, whether it was a historical person or some kind of higher ideal, was not necessarily evil or detrimental to the folk, but that perhaps it had all been turned upside down, or that the religion that formed around Jesus is the thing that was corrupt. What can you tell us about this? What were Rosenberg's thoughts on Jesus?
Well, he explains it as the personality of Jesus. So he doesn't make a claim as to the historical reality of Jesus, and it would be a mistake to do so, in my opinion. Part of the Roman Catholic Church's claim on authority is that there was no Bible for, I don't know, 300, 400 years after Christ. And, you know, so it was all a tradition that the church kept. And all they are the keepers of that tradition. They are the only ones with the direct lineage to what really happened. So we're not talking about photographs of Christ. We're not talking about, or Jesus. We're not talking about, you know, things that we can test as real. That was really, I mean, there's very little real evidence for Jesus' existence. But despite that, there is a certain personality that we see, and he points to what he sees as the truest examples of Jesus in John, which of course is very different from the other three Gospels, and then also in Mark. And he believes that even within these, there are some additions and some changes, but they have a lot of what he thinks is really the core personality of Jesus. When Christianity was, you know, kind of created, when this belief, I mean, you had a real influx of different beliefs. You had Zoroastrianism, you had the cult of Mithra, you know, and you said all these others, the Egyptians, you had Plato and Platonic thought. You know, there were a lot of different beliefs about spirituality that were all kind of collected in the Roman Empire, and in the you know, had kind of combined. And so it is natural to see kind of this strange assemblage. And within those, you actually do see things that were originally European. I mean, like kind of Northern European or whatever we want to, Aryan or whatever we want to call those people. And so we recognize some of that. In his view, you know, this was a good thing. I mean, some of what Jesus says is very good. I didn't get the impression that he believes it is indispensable. But it is stuff that is worth keeping in, you know, what is Jesus or what is Christianity. But on the other hand, his view, and it's something I strongly believe in, and just doing this one thing would utterly change Christianity in such a tremendous way. He believes we should just get rid of the Old Testament entirely. See, that's a different work for a different people. And if you imagine Christianity without the Old Testament, without the puritanical, you know, views and the examples of Isaac and Abraham and Moses and all these folks, you know, I mean,
Lot with his daughters.
Yes, exactly. You know, and all of the promises of chosen people, all of the, you know, the really kind of anti-heroes that are made to be some great, you know, fathers of the church and such. I mean, what a better religion it would have been.
King David and Esther and all just such terrible, despicable people. That's what is just so disgusting about this religion, is that the people they hold up as heroes are usually genocidal maniacs, or they just have the worst character traits. Not honorable, noble people. Whereas the European myths usually have as the highest ideal of the gods, although they don't always live up to it, honor, oath keeping, and just, of course, they will slay their enemies in battle, but they weren't this kind of vindictive, vengeful people. They're always conniving and scheming and trying to fleece those who they consider to be outside of their tribe. It's totally different mindset that's exhibited in the myths of these different people. Of course, there are many, many things about Jesus that I think have led to our world today and led to the European people having our defenses down and their arms open, so that they can go hug all of these people who want to stab them in the back. Particularly, you know, the Beatitudes, the Sermon on the Mount, blessed are the poor in spirit, blessed are they who mourn, the meek, the merciful, the peacemakers. You know, and there are obviously all these contradictions, him saying that he comes to bring the sword, he's going to set father against son, but then you've got these Christians talking about family values and bringing peace to the world. It's just, it's just such a confused kind of schizophrenic religion of cognitive dissonance, I guess, is a way to put it. At any event, what can you tell us about positive Christianity in the Reich? Did Rosenberg endorsed this? Because essentially positive Christianity is doing away with the Old Testament, right?
Yeah, I mean, you know, he doesn't talk about that so in some really formal way. It's in the myth proper. You know, he expresses a lot of thoughts about Christianity and how to improve it, and part of it is exactly what you said. I don't think it had a chance to really get any traction. There are some rumors that, you know, Hitler intended to kind of phase out Christianity after a period of time. I really don't know how true they are. You know, it would take a long time. And the strangest thing about it is there's a way that because just giving ourselves over in some submissive way to a book, whether it's the myth or the Bible or anything, is so unnatural to who we are. You know, we have to think about it for ourselves. We have to test it. We have to ask ourselves, truly, is it real? Is it right? Does it resonate with kind of the core of who we are? Our people are throwing off Christianity on their own, even in the midst of all this silliness.
Yeah. Hold that thought. We'll get to that on the other side. Folks, we have hour number two coming up and your calls.
Divide and conquer was never about placing a line between whites and blacks. That was always going to naturally happen because we are so different. It was always about whites being turned against fellow whites.
Racist this and racist that. You don't hear blacks calling each other racists, but you do hear whites calling other whites racist. You also hear white men calling white women bitches and white women calling white men pigs. It's time to cut the shit.
White men
and white women
need to become white men
and white women again. Because at the moment, white women are no longer white women.
And white men are no longer white men.
It's okay to be a lady.
It's okay to be a man.
It's okay to be white.
Thank you.
This is Renegade Broadcasting.
From north and south, where you come from, east and west, breathing just one, living in faith or dying in flame. We love, our mission is blessed. We fight for you, for freedom unforeseen. There's one, rowing along to the beat of the drum. We march the Black Cross machine. We rise, we roll. We walk and we stand tall.
Welcome back to the Solar Storm. My guest tonight is Arthur Bliss. He is a man behind sunwheel.politicallyincorrect.work. And that's where you can find the film that we're discussing here tonight, The Myth. Again, sunwheel.politicallyincorrect.work. We also posted it over there on the Tribune, so you have to go into the videos section and find it there. The first part has done very well. It has over 2,000 views at this point. Congratulations on that. I forgot to ask, how long did it take for you to produce this?
Thank you. It took about a month. Not really that bad. It was about a month. I mean, it was fairly intensive, but not too bad.
Okay, great. Well, let's get back to the topic before the break, which is positive Christianity. Anything else you want to add in regards to what the Third Reich was doing, trying to remove all of the Old Testament Torah aspects from what their people believed?
Well, yes. I mean, and it's actually something very important. And, you know, one of the things that we do is we understand other people through ourselves, through our own lens. And so we can judge the Old Testament in a certain way and say, well, that's inappropriate for us because we recognize that some of those heroes of that book are really not heroes to us. And, you know, it requires a huge amount of apologetics to justify what's going on. We are different from other people. Other people are also different from each other. And it is a really, really huge mistake that is happening all the time where we expect other peoples to be like us, to follow our moral codes, to have our values and our virtues. And, you know, we expect that, you know, people should understand that doing this is wrong. You know, that what the Muslim did in Florida, he should know that's wrong. But the truth is he was being a good Muslim. There's a fascinating book called Postville by Stephen Bloom. It's no longer you can't get it on Kindle. You have to find it in a library. But it's about Postville, Iowa. It is a very, very interesting story. I'd recommend anyone look into it. And the author is a Jew. He's, a casual Jew. He's a westernized Jew. And the story is true. I mean, basically these Orthodox, Hasidic Jews move into this very small Iowan town comprised by, you know, Norwegian and Germanic stock that are Lutherans and, you know, with a little bit of Catholicism here. And they take it over to make the world's largest kosher, meat processing plant. And they screw everyone. they bring in tons of illegal immigration. There was a huge raid. It was the largest raid in ICE history. And there's a hilarious book that is written as an apologetic for, you know, or as an excuse, you know, how this is the federal government intruding into, you know, free market and they shouldn't have done that. 50 some, you know, luminaries, Wesley Clark, all these other people have written trying to get the CEO out of jail for having done, you know, 180 illegal acts for which he was convicted of 82 of them, I think. Why is that okay? That is not okay. If people knew about this, it would be wrong. But the truth is that those people were doing what was right from their own culture, in their own people, in their own blood. They were being good Jews. And that's essentially what the book kind of just decides, is that, you know, these Jews are good Jews. They're doing what they're supposed to do. They obey the law. You know, they study the Talmud. They do the right thing for them. I can't hate them. I can't disagree that they're doing the right thing. But, you know, these Iowans are really sweet, tolerant, trusting, good people. I admire them, because this is an Ashkenazi Jew. He's not just of this, you know, so there's going to be some mixture. And there's a part of him that's kind of torn, and it's part of the Jewish dilemma, because they are a mixed people. But when we understand that, you know, a particular tribe in Africa is going to be the way they're going to be, and, you know, and a particular, you know, anyone is going to be the way that they're going to be, and stop expecting that they're going to listen to our reason, then we will free ourselves from the white man's burden. We will understand that it will not work, and that's okay. There's a story where, you know, in India, some of the Hindus were throwing their, you know, some fellow died, and they took his wives, and they were throwing them into the burning pyre, and some English soldiers, British soldiers, shot them, and they said, "You can't do that. This is what we do. This is our culture." And the Indians said, or the British said, "Okay, but this is our culture." So we stop people from you know, killing wives after the husbands are dead. It's wrong to us. That's never going to change. And it's fruitless to condemn a wolf for being a wolf, or a deer for being a deer.
Now, for a Jew, doing what's best for the Jews is obviously the highest value. They say this time and again. This is what it means to be a Jew. But the inherent character of the Jew is doing that through deception, often through lying, through scheming. And there are people on our side that figured out, hey, one of the best things you can do in life is what's best for your people. You know, that is the highest ideal. But for us, in our nature, doing what's best for our people is much, much different than a Jew being a good Jew. Could you talk about the way that Rosenberg and also yourself view the honorable nature of the European people? What is the highest value? What should we strive for in our lives?
Mm-hmm. Well, it's honor. And, you know, when we hear honor, people go, "Oh, what is that? Is that valor? Is that duty? You know, what exactly?" And those may be expressions of honor. But when Rosenberg is talking about honor, what he is really talking about is essentially recognizing natural law, natural order, that there's a nature that is within us. There's a nature to things outside of us, and that we have to be in harmony with that. And that it is our duty to exist in harmony with real nature, the nature within us and the nature outside of us. And this affects everything. This is the highest order. This is the source of our gods. I mean, you can read Snorri Sturluson and read the, you know, his prologue to the Eddas, and you see he's a Christian. This is 200 years after Christianity came to Iceland. And he's saying, you know, well, the way I believe that we used to think about these things is we looked at the earth and we looked at all of these things in nature and we said, there is something fundamental here. There are forces, there are truths within this that are, you know, as real as reality can be. And they are defined, and yet they occur in these different ways. So if we can understand kind of that archetype, that underlying spiritual truth, I mean, spiritual, however you want to call it, this, you know, super truth that is reformed in all of these natural expressions and define it as something and understand it, then that is a god. You know, it is a myth. It is a fundamental energy. It is like a location in nature. It has some true reality. And so even as we think about what we need to do as white people, or as particular kinds of white people, to care about our own tribe and so forth, which is a completely natural thing to do, I think it's good to realize that you and every person, whether they're white or not, belongs to some part of nature. And the reality is that even if, and I certainly hope this doesn't happen, because I love who we are, who I am, and who those I am blood kin with are. But even if we were to disappear, who we are, that location in nature, that fundamental source of like vital soul, is still there. And it will continue to exist. We are not just human beings. We are like the flowers of some kind of more fundamental spiritual, font. And so when we understand that, a lot of these things make sense. And it is what Rosenberg's myth is really about. So he says it comes up again and again in different people, and it's constantly renewed. It is the everlasting. It's always in the past. It's always in the future. It's always right now, because it is like, you know, that eternal soul of the people.
Compared to a lot of the Catholic Church ideas about the royalty and the bloodline of what makes a nobility, Rosenberg seemed to think that it wasn't just about blood, and he did think that pure blood was very important. Of course, that is the central theme. But it was about the achievements and the honorable actions. And so if you have a noble family that falls into depravity, if it falls out of line, out of step with the folk and its best interest, it is no longer considered noble or aristocratic. And actually, Thomas Jefferson had a similar idea about this, about the aristocracy that was inherited versus the natural aristocracy of our people. Could you comment upon this natural aristocracy and the way that Rosenberg saw it?
Well, I mean, nature, think of yourself, you know, I mean, and you know, you're always choosing an expression of yourself. And some of those expressions will be the most noble, true aspect of who you are. And some of them won't, you know, that is just true. Within a family, if 10 kids, you know, some of those kids are going to be a certain way. Some of them are others. Those kids are so very related to each other, but each one is different. Nature is searching out, you know, is stretching into the future, is remaking, you know, what is appropriate to it. And some of that is essentially, you know, is experimental. You know, it tries things. It will lean towards something. It's not always bad. Even the concept of bad is really more a sense of affinity with what is true to us. And, you know, and even within that realm of truth, we are not all the same. There's a reason for that. We're not all clones. And in the same way, you know, some of a family that is a good family of good stock, some people may tend towards one thing or another. You know, if they're really good people, I'd be very surprised if any of them really became bad people. Although we know in history that, you know, the greatest people, the most powerful, you know, creative type folks are often the ones that are most destructive when they do kind of go awry. I mean, it's almost every drama written, but there is a way in which, you know, some of us might fall down, and we have to be able to say, we don't accept that. That is ostracized. That is outside of it. Regardless of the claim of title, regardless of the position in, you know, the family or the position in society. And aristocracy holds only that, you know, that lineage, but not necessarily to the deeds. And so, you know, Thomas Jefferson, of course, had a very anti-aristocracy. He was an Enlightenment thinker. His views were very informed by people like Baruch Spinoza, who, you know, was trying to insert this kind of anti-natural, not just unnatural, but anti-nature kind of viewpoint that we are, you know, it's all tabula rasa. We're blank slates. And if we were brought up in this family or whatever, then it's purely nurture. We know that's bullshit now. You know, if we had any sense, we know it then. But he kind of believed this. So, you know, public schools were his things, for example. If within the public schools someone was great, have them come up. Rosenberg's ideas are not totally different from that. Merit by action, honor by deed. But that should be where all honor comes from anyways. It's not your name. It's not your race. If your race is just a privilege, you know, well, that's ridiculous. All of us reject that. All of us reject that. What the reason we honor who we are is because what we have done and what we will do and what we do even now.
Rosenberg is often known for this concept, the religion of the blood. We've been discussing this, but could you help to define it and perhaps even contrast it or compare it with some more recent attempts at a religion of the blood? You have William Pierce with his cosmotheism, which is something of a religion of the blood. Also the creativity movement with the creativity church founded by Ben Clausen. It had something of a religion of the blood, but I found it to be pretty materialistic. At least with Pierce's, it was a little bit tending towards higher spiritual aspirations rather than just a very physical materialistic analysis of the white race and its situation. What was Rosenberg's version? What was his idea about this religion that would be formed around the blood?
Well, essentially the idea is that the blood is who you are in your soul. It is that, you know, essential you, and it is the expressed you. So it's not simply kind of the abstract potential you and all these different, it's the real you. But by nature, you are also that soul. And the religion of the blood essentially is when the people as a group kind of form a true expression of themselves in their society. And in speaking about religion, he means especially art, because it is such a pure, at its highest, such a pure expression of the soul of a person, and collectively of the soul of a people. With Klassen and Pierce, I mean, Klassen was Ukrainian, but I mean, essentially he was American and his culture came to Canada and such. Pierce was American. You know, they have American understandings of race, and we have to move beyond this. We have to understand, for example, that not all white people are the same. I understand that in a defensive posture, if we say we will have the greatest strength in numbers if we can just kind of all band together and say all whites unite. But the truth is that, you know, not only within the many different European countries, you know, by nation, you have different blood. Even within those nations, there are, you know, different people to the town, you know.
Right.
And we have to accept this. We have to realize how essentially personal the religion of the blood must be. And being is kind of the nature of it. It is both who you are and who you become. It is a living thing. So not religion as some book of laws that dictate everything we do, but religion in the sense of an intimate connection with the soul of us, of a community of blood related people, and the expression of that in all aspects of our society. It isn't so much the final capstone on a society when it can say, okay, now here's our religion. It's really at the very root of it.
Well, since you mentioned a capstone, let's get into the Freemasonic angle here. You talked about the Freemasonic human rights and liberté, fraternité, égalité, and what that has led to. Could you elaborate upon what his thoughts were in regards to the world that the Freemasons had wrought?
Yeah, I mean, so you have folks like Léon de Poncins and Count Sherup, I don't know, it's the hidden hand or the secret world government that talk about Freemasonry. And of course, the Catholic Church has been an enemy of Freemasonry. Freemasonry is a humanitarian league. You know, it is a pure, I mean, all of our kind of modern, especially American values of equality, of liberty, of fraternity among all people are very, very, very Freemasonic. In Rosenberg's view, America is kind of the quintessential Freemasonic country. It's no surprise if you look at our dollar bill that you see, you know, some of these classic Freemasonic symbols. And they were big on their symbology and their occult kind of, you know, men's club kind of thing. And it did have its origin in the, you know, what the Illuminati, which is kind of meaningless now. I mean, who cares about the Illuminati? Because what it became was, you know, all of these things, except if you look at the real origin, and you know, De Poncins does this, Freemasonry is actually, you know, in Jewish in origin. It is a top down system of secrecy and communication that adapts the occult symbolism of the, you know, the Kabbalah and all of this stuff. And, you know, and there's, and even Satanism and all these bizarre things, they derive from Judaic beliefs. You have the Frankists and such. And, you know, it's their mysticism. It's what they do. It's part of that magical thinking that we, you know, talked about with the Etruscans. Freemasonry has some of that, but it also has the Spinoza, and Spinoza is a very interesting person. I mean, if you want to really know what happened and how the conspiracy took place, you know, read his works, because you know, he was instrumental in giving these kind of Enlightenment philosophies kind of their form, building on some of the Jewish rabbinical organization, including in the structure or in the understanding of Aristotle and so forth, but really kind of pushing forward this universalist idea, really not that different from Christianity, but turning it into a something that was kind of immune from the European sense of nationalism. And when you look at all the expressions of this, you can see, I mean, for example, the assassins that killed Franz Ferdinand and his wife, starting or being part of the start of World War I, were part of the Black Hand, right? And one of the assassins said that it was a Freemason who contacted them. He was asked if he was a Freemason. I think you can't admit if you are, or something like that. But, you know, he did it according to the code. And, you know, we say, okay, what are these silly secret societies? But the fact is, George Washington belonged to them. Benjamin Franklin belonged to them. You know, a lot of the founding fathers, appear to have been connected to these kind of secret societies. Why? Were they, you know, occultists? Or was it more like this was the elite group that would plan the society we have essentially now, the perfect utopian society where everyone is free and equal and this brotherhood of man forever and ever?
You mentioned the dollar bill with the pyramid, of course, and that brings us to financial man and trade and the acquisition of money as the highest good. What were Rosenberg's thoughts on this?
Well, you know, I mean, this is a funny thing, because we have this viewpoint that the conflict is between capitalism and communism. And so, you know, you have to choose one or the other. Is it free market or is it a state controlled market?
Two sides, you know, to the same shekel.
Exactly. That's a good way to put it. They are really just that. And as the word shekel implies, from a lot of the same thinking, it's about money. And if you study Marxism, you see it's really just about materialism. I mean, that's the essence of the philosophy. It is all about materialism. And that's all that ever matters. That's all that moves nature forward. It's the evolution of materialism. And so if you want to correct society, you do so by modifying material ways. That is the highest value, how you order things materially and especially economically. Capitalism isn't that different. I mean, for Adam Smith and the Invisible Hand and all, who you know, was kind of out of touch with what we think of as modern free market stuff, and the most boring book in the world, by the way. But the idea that the free market is going to just solve all problems is as ridiculous as a utopian perfect communist state solving all problems. Because when you take economics and you elevate it to the highest value, you put it over honor, you put it over duty, you put it over, you know, relationship, like kinship relationship, then, you know, you've disordered the world, and it cannot work, because it is not how nature works. So Rosenberg is not opposed to a lot of the things that we would, you know, that, you know, that we may think of as, well, socialism's in the word national socialism, so he must be opposed to all banks. No. He must be opposed to, you know, to private finance. No. He must be opposed to private capital, to owning property. Absolutely not. He understands that property is, you know, is essential to creative action, to purpose. You know, you do something so you can give it to those you care about, to your family, to your descendants, to, you know, for yourself. And that is natural. But, you know, you should do so in an honorable way. And if honor is elevated above, you know, whatever the money is doing, then you have a correct world. And that's for us, at least. And that's a lot of, you know, how you can drive your laws and your economic systems. So he doesn't say, here's exactly how to do it. He says, put honor first. And that means not doing this in some cases and doing this in others.
And we have our elite today selling us out so that they can make a profit, outsourcing our jobs, flooding our countries, and we are just kicked to the curb because they have no loyalty to us, because they have no honor, because they are driven only by how much they can acquire materially in this world.
Exactly.
Let's talk about eugenics and how we've had a very dysgenic world, especially since the National Socialists lost in World War II. Well, the European people lost World War II, in my opinion. And that war itself served to eliminate some of our best and brightest, our greatest warriors. And perhaps that's why we're not able to field that great of a defense in Europe and America and elsewhere today. It has a lot to do with the cultural Marxist programming and some of the chemicals they put out there and all of that. But the dysgenic effect of this war was incredible. And also just the idea now that we should give all this welfare to allow the worst of society to breed like rabbits, and we've got to tax the most intelligent and most hardworking of the society to ensure that the lower elements get all of their Section 8 and their food stamps and all the rest. What were Rosenberg's thoughts? I mean, we can obviously the audience will understand where he would stand on all of this, but what did he have to say about this in the myth?
Well, he partly believes that it's an artifact of what he considers the feminist state. And, you know, this is kind of the most triggering part of the book because, you know, there's all kinds of conflict about gender and stuff. And it's very easy to misunderstand him. And if anyone, you know, freaks out in the first 5 minutes of this section in the movie, I'd recommend they finish the section before they decide if they agree. But part of what has happened is there is a masculine sense of protective duty that most women feel only towards like their immediate children. It is not their job to go out and fight wars and to sacrifice their own lives to protect their general village.
Unless they're in Israel, where the men are back doing their religious studies and they have their women, the yentas, go fight for them.
Well, you know, of course the Jews are known for their amazing military prowess. You know, I mean, really, they'll have us do their fighting, right? Yeah. So, I mean, but the masculine spirit is to protect, is to guard these things. And the all states are, from Rosenberg's perspective, essentially masculine foundations or creations. And they are you know, leagues of men to protect what we have. And then in the safety of that essentially patriarchal, although not in a personal way, but in a structural way, society where everything really is. I mean, even to this day, you look out and you know you are pretty safe in your city because there are police. You know, if a country invades, you have an army. And these are masculine forms of protection.
Or even just the infrastructure is usually built by men. They're the ones holding it together. That is the masculine principle. Now, we're going to get into this much more on the other side. Stay tuned, everyone.
Bub, where does Buddy come from?
Well, little Jimmy, you see, the Jews print our money out of thin air and loan it back to us with interest, thus enslaving us through their usury.
Well, I never knew Jews were so good with money.
Yes, little Jimmy, that's why the Jews have been kicked out of over 109 places in 79 different countries for doing the same exact thing.
Wow, they certainly know how to parasite.
They sure do. That's why I bank with Shekelstein Credit Union. Shekelstein Credit Union, printing money out of thin air and enslaving the goyim since 1913.
Shekelstein Credit Union, they sure know how to parasite.
Welcome back to the show. If you'd like to ask a question, please call in 747-222-8807. Again, 747-222-8807. My guest tonight is Arthur Bliss, and I do hope you check out The Myth. Now, before the break, we were talking about the section on feminism and how it relates to dysgenics. And you were bringing up how there is a specific role for men in our world, and it is biologically, naturally based. And there is a very important role for women as well, and how certain parts of the film might be triggering to some, but please do stick with it, because he says, If you think I want to take the vote away from women, you're right, I do. And he says, but I'd also like to take the vote away from men, because he doesn't believe in democracy. So it really is not about equality for him, because equality is not natural. No things in nature are equal. So please pick up the discussion wherever you'd like.
Well, that's a great quote, and I like that part a lot. And later on, he explains that, you know, in a small city, you know, of less than 100,000, but say 10,000 people, where you have a chance to get to know people, then there's room for voting, because you can actually know. I mean, somebody said, well, everyone in the U.S. vote for the nicest person in the United States. You know, I mean, what kind of result would we get, right? Do we know people well enough to know if they're the nicest? We would get a celebrity. You know, we would get a popular person on TV, a TV host or something.
A reality TV star. How about
that? Yes. Yeah, for president. You know, and the truth is that we have to know people personally before we can truly vouch for them. And we have to be responsible for our vote, neither of which happen in a democracy of the scale that we have. But if you have that, then he believes women and men can both vote. So our state is feminist in the sense that it has lost that sense of patriarchal structure that protects the family, that allows women in particular to be regarded as not just subject to random men's will, but they know that they are safe. They know that they are safe. They know that their family is safe. They know their children are safe. We as a people have the sense of security because there is the strength that protects it. And that is necessary. That preserves it. But along the way, you know, that's been eroded by the same forces that have said, well, we're all equal, like you're saying. That means we don't have any individual role. We're not genders. We're this and that. We're all the same. And anything a man can do, a woman can do, perhaps better. And when we do that, then women are elevated into positions that were traditionally masculine roles, in particular in the governance of the state and the protection of the state. Women have a nature that is geared towards, motherhood. And anyone who doesn't think that there are sacrifices involved in motherhood has never either given birth or been present when someone was giving birth. There are clearly sacrifices. And of course, the 10-month pregnancy prior, you know, it is absolutely a rigorously demanding role to be a woman. It is one that, you know, they suffer from every month from menarche to menopause. There are huge sacrifices that are made in that, but they are worth it. They are worth it. A woman's duty is just as great as a man's duty, but it is directed towards the inner cultivation of the people, in the education of the children, for example, in their upbringing. I mean, no man really can compare to a healthy woman in how well they parent children. There is no mother that a man can be other than a bad mother. But men help those mothers be mothers by protecting them, by providing for them. And because they don't have all of the necessary attendant sacrifices to fulfill the duty of motherhood and femininity, they have the other duty, they have the other opportunity to be what Rosenberg calls architectonic, foundationally moving things in societally, philosophically, in a structural way towards some newly necessary truth or condition. When our society has, you know, all these women on the Supreme Court and so forth, you know, then we are going to get feminine values administering what should be masculine roles.
And not even the good feminine values. You get the Jewish feminine values. You get the degraded feminine values. So it's even worse.
Well, you know, and Jews love their mothers, but part of why they love them is because they are permissive. There is a book about, you know, the Jewish mafia, which is responsible for Las Vegas and all them. You know, they're just as responsible as the Sicilians. It's called something like, but he was good to his mother, you know. So as long as that, it's all right, right? So because women are softer to children. They are kinder. They're more tolerant. They're more forgiving. They're more patient. These are great things for mothers. They are not great things when dealing with a hardened criminal.
You know, let's say as a judge, and you have to deal with a hardened criminal. It seems now today we are more concerned as a society with protecting the individual rights of the criminals rather than protecting the folk, the nation, from those very same criminals.
Exactly. And that's precisely what Rosenberg means by a feminist state. It treats the criminals as children that should be forgiven and then guided gently back to their, you know, so the Justice Department doesn't even call them criminals or felons anymore. You know, we have to be loving and unconditionally loving and forgiving. It's really very Christian, but it's also lethal in the context of maintaining the state, protecting it from criminal influences. You know, the reality is that, you know, we have to identify when someone is a criminal and remove their ability to damage our people. And that's always been the purpose of our justice system. It's always been the purpose to protect the folk. So whether that is by imprisoning them or banishing them or sterilizing them or executing them, our purpose is to protect, right? It's, and this reforming them and teaching, that's what you do with a child. A child does something wrong, you give them a consequence and they learn their lesson. These men in particular, but women as well, who commit the crimes that we see today, and they're not new crimes, but, you know, we see a lot of them. We're treating them like our children. They are not our children. And likewise, we treat the refugees in the world. We treat the starving Africans. We treat the starving anyone's and the, you know, incoming immigrant hordes as our children that we must take in, that we must love even to our own death. Yes. That is very feminine and very sweet and very dangerous if it comes to ruling the state. So men haven't been doing their job. The reason women have done this, have been able to, is because men said, all right, you're equal. We love you, ladies. We want to be, you know, white knights and to respect you and do all these things. And, you know, we've been told, we've been taught equality, you know, tolerance. We believe it. We're fully westernized in this, you know, Jewish Enlightenment tradition. And so, yes, be all that you can be. We're going to support you 100%. And so, you know, but the worst thing about it, and this is an observation Rosenberg makes, I think is just spot on, is that women never have really achieved being men. They've just essentially betrayed their own gender. I mean, what is feminism in the modern sense, other than trying to be like a man?
Remember Hillary Clinton's pantsuits that she used to always wear? Maybe she still does, but
she's a pantsuit enthusiast. But she's, you know, essentially it is anti-woman.
Janet Reno. You think of some of these powerful women who have been. Well, in some cases, some of these powerful women, I think, actually are men, like Michelle Obama. But that's a different story here. We definitely have a situation where our men are not acting like men. They're acting like, I guess, feminized little bitches. And then our women are trying to act like men. And then we've got, 31 different flavors of gender? You know, the new Baskin-Robbins, Facebook will let you choose 31 different flavors, whatever your gender identity falls. But it's ridiculous. I don't think that Rosenberg would have been able to foresee the level of depravity that would result from them losing. Maybe he would have. He wouldn't be too surprised if he was to, you know, have been taken in a time machine. Here's what happened after you lost. Okay, we're not going to execute. We're going to show you the future. That's going to be your punishment. Is you're going to have to see what happens with all these 70 plus years of Jewish rule. And I mean, it would be shocking to anybody back then to come into the world today and say, whoa, this is what is considered normal.
Well, it would seem so. And I'm sure that's true about many specifics, because we as a people have so lost our way. I mean, we're all virtualized and kind of half of us are on drugs, whether prescription or not. I mean, we're a very disconnected people. And so, yeah, just our response to these travesties, I'm sure would be shocking. Where is the common sense? Where is the sense that you are this and not that? But the reality is that even before Rosenberg, if you study the works of Engels, for example, you know, when his book about the family, or even look in the Communist Manifesto, you know, it says abolition of the family. You know, the family is the enemy, because there is nothing more racist than a family. There's nothing more racist than a family.
And that's why they push the race mixing for the families, or adopting black children if you're a white couple. That's it.
Exactly. And everything that you really need to know about how to be, you know, in tune with your own people, you can understand through how a family ought to be, you know, acknowledging the nature of it. But we live in a time where where gender is a construct. I mean, race, at least, you know, you had scientific, I guess there's always, you know, it's the Edward Bernays kind of thing of the scientific propaganda. When will people stop listening to the priests of science or the priests of media and just say, what do my own eyes show me? What does my own life teach me? That's all we really need to do, and understand ourselves in that.
Yeah, the indoctrination overrides the common sense for way too many people. Mm-hmm. And it has no real scientific basis. It's a new form of kind of mysticism. It's getting people to believe in these ideas that have no basis in reality. They just have to believe. That's the key word of indoctrination. Teaching people what they have to believe, not what they should know, what the facts are, what wisdom says, but what the official doctrine is.
Now, people are naturally going to be inclined to go with the crowd. It's not a bad thing where you have a people, you know, but when you have it so subverted, whether by priests or you know, politicians or press, I mean, it is very dangerous. And we have to, at the very least, present to people, you know, that here's another way of thinking about it, so they can decide for themselves. Let them feel like they, you know, that they can be free. I mean, we are, I believe, the most free thinking of all the peoples in the world. We're not the best at everything, but that's part of who we are, is that imagination, that spark.
Wild. We have a wild tendency to us that I think has perhaps been tamed out of others, or maybe that's just in their nature to be a little bit more submissive. But the white man is hard to hold down. I think that's why they're trying to get rid of us rather than just enslave us. We've never made the greatest of slaves.
That's exactly right. And they are, you know, and they're succeeding, and they will succeed. And everything that you're doing and, you know, and that we're doing is really about the long-term future. Because at this point of time, we're in that early part of the cycle that Le Bon talks about, where we are just instilling in those future, you know, thought leaders, the people who are really going to be architectonic, who are going to have families that are aware of these things, and that when the time comes, because everything that is going on is unnatural and therefore unsustainable. So when the time comes that the Roman Empire is crumbling, then the Visigoths may come in, but they're not going to stay. We can return to the way we are, you know, and essentially return to the myth.
Well, I am hoping that now that we're in the era of light speed technology, we can speed things up at light speed here and perhaps get things rolling really quickly such that our future generations don't have to go through hell to get to what might look like them to be heaven. I really do think it's possible for us to reclaim our destiny pretty quickly. It really has to do with our people just getting their minds right. If our people had their minds right, we could do this in weeks. It's obvious. We would be able to dominate our opposition within weeks. The numbers, the intelligence, the firepower, all of it is on our sides. If only we were smart enough, if only we were aware enough to reach out and grab that power and work together.
Well, let's say that is the case now. But let's say also that it isn't the case in 15 years or 20 years. Let's say that, you know, the immigration and all, you know, the refugees and all these things have continued. They've swarmed our lands, you know, and we who have always been a minority in the world, you know, have to recede. You know, maybe it already happened. Maybe after, you know, maybe with the glaciers, as the hordes from the south, you know, were there. And when the glaciers were melting, we moved to the north with those. You know, why? Why were people as potent as, you know, retreating? We remain the people who survive, with the exception of a few, you know, native folks, the best in cold weather. We need to, I think, find folks that are very close kin to us. If you're Finnish, then be with Finnish people or mostly Finnish people, etc. You will find most commonality with those people and live where it is cold. Because no matter what happens in the future, you know, we may not be able to control Vietnam or China or, you know, but we can still live in those areas, and what we are will never die.
Rosenberg was against what he saw as colonialism in China, particularly on behalf of the British and I'm sure the Americans as well. And he seems to have an interesting take on Islam as well. What can you say about his view and also kind of the National Socialist view on relations with the other races and imperialistic kinds of aspirations?
Well, I think that every, you know, left person who thinks that they are a left wing, who has a you know, instinctive aversion to the National Socialist, and, you know, should probably read this chapter, it will disabuse them of a lot of notions that they have. Rosenberg is no fan of Western imperialism. He's no fan of colonialism. He's certainly no fan of missionary work in other countries. And it's not just because doing so doesn't serve the interests of his own people. He believes it is kind of a sin against nature to try to go into a different people's land and convert them to be like you, whether that's the perfect ideal of you or whether it's some distorted, you know, Enlightenment version of you. It disrespects them as a people. It is dishonorable to do so because it violates the laws of nature, that they are them. It's taking all those wolves and saying, now you're all vegetarians, you know, or vegans. It's not in their nature. It is wrong to do that. And he uses the example of China in particular. And you know, remember, this was before Mao, and he saw it all coming. You know, he saw the storm rising. He was not alone in seeing it, but he knew it was coming. And, you know, that the oppression of the Chinese, you know, which was already starting to fire up with the Boxer Rebellion and such, was going to come to a head because it was not right. And we have to own this. You know, we cannot become, what we were as America, for example, or as, you know, the EU or this kind of entity that is going, or, you know, the British Empire, or any empire. Doing so is wrong. America must fall. It is an unnatural entity, but any empire like that must fall. It is unnatural and it's dishonorable for us to do so. He's sympathetic. As he says, East Asia to the East Asians.
Yeah, he really is the one who seemed to have come up with the mantra.
Yes, there you go.
it's almost word for word in some regards. It's you know, to each his own, essentially.
And the same with Africans and all these things. He says, let them have their own places. It's the only way. And it is not just like it's only a practical way. It's the right thing.
Mm-hmm. I think so. He saw a big problem with America, the American melting pot, the mixing that has already gone on, had already gone on back then. It wasn't as drastic as it was today, but he also did see that there was an opportunity for America, this new country, to become the racial state. Could you tell us a little bit about his vision of what America could or should become?
Mm-hmm. Well, so he, you know, at that time, you know, until 1965, most of the folks of other race in this country besides white race were black. And then there was a not insignificant population of Asians, primarily Chinese and some Japanese. And then, of course, you had folks who were American Indians. There weren't a lot of you know, Mexicans and stuff, which are, of course, you know, mestizos with some American Indian in them. But that was, you know, less of a thing. Of course, now that's a very significant portion of the population. So he talks mostly about blacks, and blacks are very, very different from white people. And this is fine, but the idea that folks are going to integrate is insane. And
Lincoln agreed. Abraham Lincoln definitely agreed with that.
Muhammad Ali agreed. You know? Yeah. I mean, everyone who thinks about these things and does not deny the nature of people, in other words, doesn't fall into this thought that we're all the same and race is just a color and stuff, recognizes that as part of the diversity and beauty of life. But, you know, especially sub-Saharan Africans and these West African folks, I mean, they are different from us. And they are not happy in the society except where it acts as like a jungle full of food. You know, I mean, welfare is, everyone likes welfare if they don't have a sense of, you know, we have to be creating. So it's easy to grow a population with welfare. But, you know, but what won't happen is blacks becoming white. They are who they are, and that is fine. And whites will not become blacks despite the, you know, earnest attempt of lots of urban white teenagers.
Oh, sickening.
Yeah. I mean, and it's ultimately, it's okay. We have to let go of this universalism. But America, you know, at that time was wrestling with these issues. And, of course, they had just experienced a big infusion of Southern European immigration, which he doesn't talk about, but I mean, it was changing. So he says either, you know, clean your house, send the Africans back to Africa, send the Asians back to Asia, make sure they have, and don't intrude if Japan needs some more space beyond its overcrowded island, that's, you know, let them figure that out. And let America be a country for white people. Of course, he doesn't agree with the Freemasonic stuff. But, you know, but what we've seen since then, I mean, because this was in 1930, a huge number of European Jews moved to the United States. A huge number later moved to Israel. He has some interesting thoughts about that aren't that different. Essentially, they need their own land, but he distrusts the Jews because of their, you know, the way that they exist is so dependent on other people. So really their own nation, really they work, you know, and support themselves in a completely self-sufficient way. He doesn't really think that's going to happen. But with America, it could. Except it is probably too late. He sees it as a land of opportunity, of great you know, resource and wealth, of a lot of really great people. You know, in some of the parts that were omitted, he talks about the different peoples that have, you know, come there, like the Germans, and recognizes that, you know, those were some of the Germans that, that were kind of on a different view of things, but they were in their stock good people. And, you know, and when we think about American culture, it really is German culture, hamburger and apple pie included, you know.
Right. Yeah, it definitely is. And it's very sad to see how that has really transformed. I've seen it myself in certain cities where you had, Cincinnati over the Rhine? I forget where it was, but I've seen this place that used to be German. They renamed all the streets and now it's completely black. And on the outskirts live some Jews, the blacks and Jews living symbiotically. We have run out of time here. So please, any final thoughts, and also please promote your work, anything you might have coming up as well. Let people know where they can find you.
Okay. Well, I really appreciate, you know, you having me on, Kyle. I really think what you're doing with the show is very good and a very noble thing. And, I'm thankful. And whenever I see things like you're doing and the other hosts doing and this kind of this new group of people that, I at least was unaware of 5 years ago, but certainly was not visible and many people were not doing these things, you know, it really fills me with hope. And maybe we will have a transformation of the soul, you know, sooner than it's happened in the past. Maybe we can avert kind of an economic collapse, and well, not so much economic as a demographic collapse. But regardless of what happens with any individual country, I think the most important thing for people to understand from Rosenberg, but also from what they can experience in their own life right now, especially if they are trying to find kind of like some real purpose, because, you know, we've been deluded from it. They need to understand who they are. They need to understand, you know, it, whether they are historically minded, they can study their history, or they can just look at, you know, or kind of sense it. But we often are so out of touch with who we are. And it is the most important thing, because it is the myth. It is the myth that lives again. And it's the myth that will live again through our children, through future generations, through the future of our people. And it is our job to try to do the best we can according to the values that are appropriate to our people. It's everyone's job. But for us, that means being honorable. So even if we can get ahead, even if we could help people by lying to them, even if we can, you know, do some scoundrel kind of activity, but we're going to win, we shouldn't. Because one of the things that I think it's also important to understand is that part of the concept of honor is that we, you know, even if we fail, we will. It is worth it if we've done the right thing.
I think we'd see a Pyrrhic victory if we did the wrong thing in order to win. I really want to thank you so much for coming on. I thought it was a fascinating show. Sunwheel.politicallyincorrect.work. Check it out. You're a slave. Thanks for tuning in. To the capitalist system. Stay tuned to RenegadeBroadcasting.com. I'll be back next week. Which is ruled by the global elite. What happened to the individual? What happened to working class white?
Now, let's hear from a Jewish academic.
My concern is doing away with whiteness. Whiteness is a form of racial oppression, sure. The suggestion is that it is somehow possible to separate whiteness from oppression, and it is not. There can be no white race without the phenomenon of white supremacists. In the same way, if you abolish racial oppression, you do away with whiteness. Treason to whiteness is loyalty to humanity.
Your views are fairly well received in academia.
Yes, they're legitimate. Not to say that everyone agrees, but sure. And the task is to bring this minority together in such a way that it makes it impossible for the legacy of whiteness to continue to reproduce itself.